they can't walk it back.
And make it look like I meant to. Like a cat running into a glass door, make it look like you did it on...
You can't walk away nonchalantly.
Welcome again to Darwin Denied. And this week it's my turn to introduce a book of my choice for the Essential Bookshelf. And I've picked one of my favorites. It's called Icons of Evolution by Jonathan Wells. And what's wonderful about this book is that not only does he have two PhDs, he's a very bright man. He basically goes through a number of icons. And what he means by icons are symbols of Darwinism that are well known to the majority of the public. And not just symbols, but these are go-to evidential cornerstones for the theory of evolution. The National Academy of Science is very much committed, they say, to truth. And yet, the icons that they continue to promote in the schools, in the curriculum, college biology textbooks, high school biology textbooks, all of these foundational evidences are often exaggerated, or there's some kind of distortion or deception going on. Sometimes the deception is they themselves are deceived. They don't even realize that they're twisting it. But what Jonathan Wells does is he goes through, does some very, very good research looking at the veracity of these icons and showing that they are not all that they're cracked up to be. Some of them you may recognize, the origin of life experiments called the Miller-Urey experiments, Darwin's Tree of Life, many people are familiar with that. Homology and vertebrate limbs, we're familiar, humerus, radius, ulna, carpals, metacarpals, phalanges, and how many vertebrates have that same bone pattern. That's one example of homology. And a number of others, Haeckel's embryos, Archaeopteryx, peppered moths, Darwin's finches, four-winged fruit flies, fossil horses, and the ultimate icon, the ape to human series. And these are, again, they appear over and over again in not just biology curriculum. It seeps into so many other sciences as well as the soft sciences. It's amazing how many different disciplines Darwinism trickles into, not just the biology disciplines. And so he does the research, and he pulls back the veil and shows that there's often a lot of exaggeration and distortion to these things. And when you look deeper, you realize, golly, it's almost as if, you know, reminds me of the Wizard of Oz when the characters in Wizard of Oz are all frightened by the ominous presence of the wizard, and then they pull back the curtain, and it's this little old man. Then he was no longer scary, no longer formidable, and that's what he does. The other thing about Jonathan that I really like is not only is he very rigorous in his research, he's also very scrupulous about accuracy. A few years ago, when I was speaking at a homeschool Institute of Science conference, I was co-speaking with Jonathan Wells, and I had said something in my talk that was sort of a distillation, sort of something that was a little more simplified about how DNA codes for proteins that I'd heard, and I'd been taught that, and I continued to state it the same way I'd heard it. It was for the most part correct, but it wasn't quite exacting. And Jonathan came up to me afterwards and very graciously said, you know, you actually should say this, not that, about how you described it. And I said, yeah, you're right. And it showed me right there that he was very, very concerned about accuracy. And he even had reviewers review his book, even evolutionists who weren't really on board with his, you know, where he was going with this. But he had them review it to make sure that it was accurate. And they signed off, yeah, this is accurate. They're real distortions that continue to be inculcated into the public mind. And definitely science needs public buy-in. And so they want to keep packaging these things, deceptions and all, because they're shrink-wrapped, they're polished, but they're way more polished than they actually are. And that's where the deception and distortion gets in.
So would you say that these icons are as trotted out as they are, as often as they are, because that's the best they've got? Or is it, are they appealed to so often because of inertia? People just, they're in the textbooks and might as well keep them there.
Yeah. Now that a lot of this is out, they'll realize, okay, we might need to dial back and make some more qualifications on these things. And some textbooks have sought to say that, but they still keep repeating them because they are the best go-to they've got. Now, there are certain evidences that are a little bit more nuanced and a little bit more complicated that they think, okay, the lay public, this might be just over their head. So they keep going back to the simpler ones.
These are the best they've got for popular propagation.
Yeah, for popular consumption.
So you mentioned, I think it was Haeckel's
embryos,
the ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny.
Right.
So the stages of embryonic development are supposed to recapitulate the process of evolution.
Evolution, yeah.
When was that first debunked?
I think it was in the 19th century that. Yeah, it was proposed after Darwin's theory was starting to roll, and so embryologists, the deeper they dug into the development of the bodies, not just of humans but all sorts of vertebrates, they realized that really that whole notion of ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny is not true at all. There's so many things that just, when you get down into the details, it just
and yet you still see that
you keep seeing it. And the thing that he exposes there was that Haeckel fudged the drawings to make this particular stage in embryological development of fish and amphibian and reptile and bird and mammals, that certain stage, he made them look much more similar than they actually are. And so evolutionists acknowledge that it was fraudulent, but they still think, well, the idea is still a valid one. But the embryologists, even the evolutionary embryologists say, no, that's sort of been debunked a long time ago. But
so pretty much everyone has seen the horse series. That's right. That's one of the icons there.
Yeah, that's one of the icons there.
So now it seems to me that if we had a great flood in our day and everybody died, or most everybody died, and the flood washed through the local dog pound.
Today,
and then buried downstream a chihuahua up to an Irish wolfhound, you know.
Yeah, provided that they were in some sort of vertical series.
It'd be the work of 10 minutes to arrange
them in an evolutionary order.
And it reminds me of, I don't know if you remember, if you had this, but back in elementary school where you learned new vocabulary words and they gave you 10 words that were new and they said, write a story using all these 10 words. And it's as though the evolutionists are saying, write a story using these fossils.
Right. And that's what they've done. They've got their story figured out. It's the same with the ape human sequence. They've got the story, the narrative. Really, paleoanthropologists are the evidence is so fragmentary and so little compared to what you would actually need to have the complete story, that they're often considered storytellers. They've even referred to themselves. I think people in their honest moments will say, yeah, we're storytellers. It's like trying to reconstruct the entire plot of War and Peace by 13 randomly selected pages.
I think one time you told me, maybe this was you, if you took the whole entire evolutionary tree, if evolution were true, if you took the entire evolutionary tree as it had to have existed throughout history, how much of that tree do we have fossils of or evidence? Yeah, how much of it do we have?
I really don't know, but it's very little. And they acknowledge it's very little. And even Darwin acknowledges it's very little.
Didn't you have an evolutionary prof who said that he had like three twigs out of the tree or something?
I don't think it was me. If it was me, I don't remember. But it is really a small piece of the pie. But they still think that they can piece together the entire tree with little evidence. One of the other reasons I would recommend it is that he's a good writer. It's not just that he's clear. He's got a great voice. It's a pleasure to read. He's got sort of a fireside chat voice that is just an enjoyable cadence. And there are some writers that you feel it's like to read them is like walking on an uneven sidewalk. You're constantly tripping over, oh, I was expecting that word and it was this word, and it's just a halting writing style. And Jonathan Wells is an excellent writer and an extremely intelligent man and scrupulous about accuracy.
So what do you think it is that if you took a discredited something that was a thing at the time, like the Piltdown Man, that was discredited,
right?
And the discrediting was accepted, right? You know,
right.
Yeah, the Piltdown Man went down.
It went down.
Why do some of these other icons that are equally discredited? I mean, Piltdown Man was like a built up out of a tooth.
Well, it was an orangutan jaw and a human skull, and the orangutan jaw was treated with acid to make it look old. So it was the skull was pretty old, considerably older than the jawbone of the orangutan, and that was the teeth were filed down to make them look a little more human-like. So it was obviously a fraud, but that hoax was sort of treated as fact for decades.
Right.
And they'll say, well, this is a self, you know, it shows that science is self-correcting.
Right.
But how many people have been deceived in the meantime? So it's important that,
Was it more of a slam dunk, this was a hoax on the Piltdown Man, as opposed to a mistaken reasoning? So...
No, it was a slam dunk that this was a deliberate hoax.
But is that why it went down? So there are a number of these other icons that you might say the...
Oh, no, yeah. Most of these icons are not hoaxes. These are honest people saying... Or relatively speaking, honest people doing good research. In some of the cases, very good research, like Peter and Rosemary Grant and their research in the Galapagos Islands. Over several decades
on the finch,
and they've. I mean, it's it is amazingly good, rigorous field biology. They've just taken many, many measurements. And so the collection of data is great. The analysis of data is great in one sense. They're not fudging the numbers at all. It's just their extrapolation and trying to fit it into this narrative. Okay, beaks of the medium ground finch, the beak size after a drought, the average beak size on the medium ground finch went up a half a millimeter. And so you see this, you know, this is natural selection, and it is natural selection at work. And so there's this great excitement among the evolutionists that this is a case of natural selection. But every creationist I know, even the most hardcore creationists, would totally embrace that kind of selection.
Microevolution.
And microevolution, right.
So the difference is they maintain that macroevolution
is a lot of micro.
Is the brick wall, and microevolution is the brick.
Right. They would just say it's a lot of accumulated micro. And this is the main difference is that, you know, it's Darwin called it descent with modification. And I think that's, in one sense, an accurate statement, because your descendants may be modified from you. Well, no one really disputes descent with modification. I would dispute descent with augmentation, where you have evolution actually, you know, unguided processes, not just tweaking a finch beak or changing the color of the plumage, which may be an adaptive change in a population. That is totally accepted by creationists. It's evolving something new from scratch. It's not just changing a species, because this is where I think there can be some confusion. Can one species become two? Well, I think most creationists believe that one species become two. I mean, case in point, there's about 20 or so different species of chipmunks in North America. And no creationist would assert that Noah brought on the ark
all 20.
Right. They would say that there was one common ancestor of chipmunk, or even some creationists would assume that it's not just chipmunks, but squirrels are in that same created kind. And I don't want to go there. The main point is that you can have speciation, but there's no increase in complexity. You're just changing the same basic morphological equipment on that particular animal or plant, and having those various features be changed to fit that environment.
Brown bears, black bears.
You know.
So, and it should be self-evident that if you talk to creationists, are those who believe in Adam and Eve, right? Mm-hmm.
And look at
all the people. So, or Noah and the Ark. So, according to a strict creationist, we're all descended from Noah and his wife,
right?
And whatever race they were,
and his boys and their boys' wives.
And most of us are not whatever they were. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got blacks and Asians and whites and pygmies and you know,
so many. I mean, go to the mall,
right?
It's amazing how many body shapes there are, hair color, hair texture, skin color, all from this. I think of a kind as a genetic kaleidoscope, where it's limited to the certain crystals in that kaleidoscope, and you can make an amazing array of patterns from that set of crystals, but you're not getting new stuff. Same with a deck of cards. You can keep shuffling the cards and getting all sorts of different hands, but you can't just keep shuffling and expect to get a new suit.
Right.
Okay? And that's what evolution needs to, you know, a little bit of a micro isn't going to add up to, you know, no matter what kind of selection pressures you put on me, humans or any mammal are not going to grow feathers unless there's DNA that codes for feathers.
Mm-hmm.
So no amount of selection will cause people, no matter how much time you give us,
right,
will we grow feathers. We might change the texture of our hair, color of our hair, all sorts of things, but no feathers.
Okay, so creationists believe in microevolution, variation within species, sometimes significant variation within species, like
a wolf and a dog. Right, but they would be considered, and this is where you have to define species, because many creationists say, oh, they kind encompasses quite a few species.
When you say kind, you're talking about the biblical word.
The biblical word for kind, which may, we can get into, lots of detail there, but the main thing is that a kind would have the genetic potential to generate quite a few species, but those species, have blurry boundaries. Often they can hybridize with other species, like those chipmunks I was talking about, or many, many species can truly hybridize. They just don't do so in nature very often. It usually happens in artificial.
Like a breeder could breed for certain kinds of traits.
Yeah, and snake breeders, reptile breeders can actually breed things that were in different genera, that's the plural of genus. They can actually get hybrids on two different genera.
Right.
So anyway, I wanted to just kick a question over to you. It's more of a broad, more big picture, since you're sort of a cultural engagement type ninja.
Ninja.
Anyway, you're this is not just an intellectual exercise, the whole creation evolution controversy. This is the battle for minds and hearts of nations. Mm-hmm. And it says in 2 Corinthians 10, I think, that we are to cast down every argument that sets itself up against the
knowledge
of God. Today, Darwinism, naturalism, uniformitarian, any kind of ism that seeks to push God out of the picture, make God not part of the equation, that God is not causative to any of it, is an idea, it's a philosophy, it's an argument that sets itself up knowledge of God.
And it has to go down.
So with that, these books, we've got, since the last few decades, we've had a number of creationist books, quite a few. We've had intelligent design books. This is in the intelligent design camp. And they're sort of assaulting this big, what is considered this unassailable fortress of Darwinism. And it's like a bat. Just each one has a whack. It's a battering ram. And we see, from our perspective, the gate is the wood starting to splinter. It's not just battering rams. We got trebuchets. We got flaming arrows. We've got siege mounds being built up against this fortress of Darwinism. Do you see in a paradigm, from your strategic perspective, do you think, okay, keep it coming?
Yeah.
Keep it coming? Should we just keep swinging? And eventually, hopefully in my lifetime, I'd like to see it all go down. Or do you think the paradigm shift will be so slow that we won't even know when we actually took the fortress down?
Yeah.
Or do you think we should pull back and go, let's regroup, let's rethink this whole thing? They seem to not be getting our assault. They don't seem to be responding to our assault. Should we find some apologetics Spock that knows the Vulcan nerve pinch and can just grab Darwinism and have Darwinism crumple to the ground? Do we need to go after something like that, or let's just keep the battering rams coming?
Yeah, I think keep up the assault. I would argue keep up the assault from creationists, from the ID people, from the people who wouldn't identify with any camp, but they're just intellectually honest, like
right.
Thomas Nagel,
right.
Mind and Cause,
or
Mind
David Berlinski, who
they're intellectually honest, but they don't belong to a camp. Then you've got the ID people who are doing a lot of good work. Then you've got the old guard creationists who were doing ID work before ID work was cool.
Right.
So you've got all of those. And as it happens, I'm going to mention three books here. One of them we're going to treat in an upcoming episode of Darwin Denied. And I mentioned in our first episode that there are some books that are not written by anti-evolutionists at all, but they're extremely relevant to this. And that mm-hmm. book is one of my selections, and it's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions by Thomas Kuhn. And he's the one who popularized the phrase paradigm shift. Mm-hmm. So when evolution goes down, it will be a massive paradigm shift. And he describes in detail how scientific revolutions happen.
Right.
Right. And I believe that Darwinism is going to go down that way, where little problems accumulate. This is a preview of what we're going to talk about. It's like a wagon. The old decrepit paradigm is a wagon full of rocks, and one day it just breaks down. It just mm-hmm. can't go anymore. And so you replace it with a new wagon, the new paradigm. But on day one of that new wagon, it's got rocks in it. You know, there's anomalies. But a new, fresh wagon that everybody's excited about, they don't care. It can carry the rocks. So all the Darwinian anomalies and problems, and that's not consistent. Darwinism has carried for a century or more.
160 years.
But the rocks are really accumulating. So every creationist book is throwing another cinder block in this
right.
wagon. And someday, at some point, the wagon just collapses. It can't
right.
carry the weight of it anymore. And that's Kuhn's.
Now, when Kuhn wrote it, he didn't have in mind
Darwinism. He may make a passing reference to evolution, but he's not talking about evolution
at all. Because he doesn't think it.
right. But he is talking about scientific revolutions. And
right.
before the revolution happens, the critic is a nut job, and afterwards he's a visionary.
Right.
A
hero.
So we're gonna spend a whole episode on
right.
Kuhn's book. Another book is not about science, but it's The Black Swan by Taleb. And basically, when the Soviet Union went down, most people didn't see it coming. A black swan is something that can happen, but rarely happens. And when mm-hmm. it happens, everybody's surprised. So, and mm-hmm. then I read The Black Swan because I said on my blog one time, you know, every event that happens, however remarkable in history, once it happens, it can be shown to have been inevitable by any competent historian. So mm-hmm. a historian could go back prior to that time and show how the Reformation was inevitable or the Enlightenment was inevitable.
Right.
But nobody saw it coming. 2 years, 2 years
right.
before it happened, nobody predicted it.
Right.
Or if someone predicted that the Soviet Union would collapse, they were crazy. That was crazy talk until
mm-hmm.
until it came down.
Right.
And when that happens, it's sort of an all at once. It's like the dam breaking.
Right.
The last book I'd mention is one we might or might not get to. A scientific journalist named Tom Bethel wrote a very good book called House of Cards, and he's sort of describing the history of Darwinism in a journalistic way, and he concludes his last pages are describing how much trouble Darwinism is in. And one of his arguments, which I thought was very good, is that the hard scientific evidence that would make evolution compelling is pretty thin,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah, it's and so you say, well, why was it so readily accepted by the scientific world? Well, Bethel points out that in the 19th century, when Darwin published, there was a parallel track, and the whole all of Western civilization had a deep-seated belief in progress.
Mm-hmm.
Right, it was the Enlightenment optimism of progress,
right.
progress, progress, and the progress. This belief in progress was sort of like the flying buttresses that supported the cathedral of Darwinism.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that unvarnished optimistic faith in progress is long gone from our culture.
Mm-hmm.
So Darwin needed that support, that worldview support from the optimistic culture around to say we're going to advance and advance and advance. And now that that faith is gone and the critics are mounting and we're saying, well, what about this and what about this and what about this? They don't have the reinforcements that they used to. Right. So I pray God that Darwinism is going to go down in my lifetime also. And I think that that's quite possible because I think when it goes, it's going to go in a rush.
I hope so. I don't want it to go slow, partly because I want the poetic justice of it. We all love the Book of Esther where, you know, everything's going great for Haman. And then everything just turns at the last moment, and you can see his face blanch because he's thinking he's at the top of his game, and now he's going to his own gallows that he had built for Mordecai. And I sort of want, you know, the international community of evolutionists to have a Haman moment.
Yeah,
I really, really would like that. But I'm wondering if it will be more of a, oh, the cart is cracking, let's move the rocks over, you know, slowly, because it's amazing how scientists can posture themselves in a way that looks like, oh, we knew it was coming along.
Except like there's the commitment to materialism, the commitment to atheistic materialism or methodological naturalism is so deep, and it has gotten so strident and so religious and a fiercely defended orthodoxy. Right. I don't see any way they can't walk it back.
I meant to, like a cat running into a glass door, make it look like he did it on.
You can't walk away nonchalantly.
Yeah.
No.
I'm hoping that's the case. So. Yeah.
And if it happens, we will work on keeping our motives pure.
Yeah. Okay. No gloat. Do not gloat enemy falls. So.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is Courtney Skeen.
My name is Tim Clemens.
Curtis Spencer.
Emily Davis.
I'm Josh Clemens.
My name is Gwen Burrow, and I graduated in 2010. I've been working as a writer, editor, and event planner.
And I'm currently working as an account manager.
Engineering company and cybersecurity.
Computer programmer and data engineer.
It's a financial planning company.
I work for a small tech company here in Moscow, Idaho.
That's actually one of the best things I've ever taken away from NSA is how to learn. How to study. I had never had to push myself that hard, ever. And I clearly needed it, especially at age 23. I was capable of more than the college I had been going to and what it demanded of me. So I needed the push in the languages, the push in deadlines, and then the challenge of the grading system itself. It was all amazing.
Being able to be interested in anything and everything and being willing and able to go out and research it all the way down to the ground.
Having all of those skills and the understanding of people and understanding of how to communicate opens up a lot of job opportunities.
You think of yourself now and then in 4 years' time, what do you want yourself to look like? And is the education that you're considering going to help you get to that place?
When you're a student, you want to become like your teacher. You're going to become like your teacher. And so you want to be studying under people who you know you want to become. And looking at NSA beforehand, I knew I wanted to become like the men who are teaching here.
Fireman, husband, father, doctor, no matter where you want to go, NSA is just such good preparation for the person that you want to be.
If you want to be an effective Christian, you need to be able to lead and shape culture. If you want to do that, no matter what your occupation is, you need to shape yourself, prepare yourself as a person for that job. And liberal arts is, I think, the best education you can have for that.